It's June. Happy summer, everybody. Some of you might be California dreaming, so
we've got two California-born and bred ranchers with us today. Longtime rancher Frank Fitzpatrick, owner at Five Bar Beef in Orange County, took regenerative agriculture seriously from the get-go and knows it's his job to not only protect and enhance the environment, but in doing so, will raise and provide high-quality, nutritious food for all. And first-generation shepherd Dylan Boken, founder of Boken House Hearth and Husbandry in Ojai, raises sheep and lambs with a keen eye on the regenerative partnership that sustains healthy life and mitigates fires, too. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio, June 2023. Grab your earbuds and or a shovel, and let's dig in. Frank, tell us about your ranch, the Five Bar Beef in Orange County, the acreage, terrain, rainfall, and your herd.
Okay, that's a tough one. I lease about 200,000 acres in Northern California, and I have about 700 head of cattle that are run on that ranch conventionally. I have three ranches. All three of them actually are grazing leases. One of them I've had for 25 years. The other two have been 3 and 4 years. Total acreage down here is about 900 acres, and we do holistic plant grazing on this piece. We're using conventional hot wire to get the paddock straightened out. We made 19 moves this year. We got about 40.5 inches of rain. That's the best rainfall year we've had since 1969. We grew a lot of grass and a lot of weeds this year. I got 700 head of fat cattle.
They're happy out there this year, I bet.
Yes, ma'am, they are. I started this cow herd in 1979 in Idaho. I was born and raised here in Orange County. I live in a house that I moved into on my 4th birthday. Anyway, I moved from Idaho to Oregon. I moved from Oregon to Winnemucca, Nevada. I ran on 4 or 5 different ranches. I've had about 14 ranches since I've been moved. I'm what you really call a scattered cattle company. The only integrated part of the whole thing has been the cow herd. These are all derivative of a purebred Arizona strain. The original 7 cows I bought were all NO cows. I bought 22 cows 2 years later, and these were all NO cows or NZ cows, which was the original barn foundation. And then the first derivative, that was Neil Hampton, which was the NZ cows. We bought 600 axles of semen when we bought the cows. When we ran out of semen, we stopped buying semen and bulls. So I've had a closed herd now for 44 years. This is probably the most inbred herd of cows, I would guess, in America.
What are the benefits of that?
If you take a genetics class, there's only two ways you can commingle genes. You're trying to increase the gene frequency of heritable traits. And I have decided on just two. I select for fertility and growth. Basic herd criterion is you have to have a calf every year, or I send you down the road. And if you are a bull that gets to breed cows in my herd, you show the greatest amount of gain and still have large amount of secondary sex characteristics. The biggest bull you raise is always a steer. It is epiphysis don't close and they're not fertile. But after you look down one or two, you find some highly masculine bulls that are really fertile, that are really growthy, and those are the ones I breed my cows to. That's the criterion, been that way since we started.
So with these other ranches north that you run, you said they're conventional?
Yeah. It's really hard to get people that own ground to let you do holistic plant grazing.
Yeah, I've heard that,
yes. I have better luck getting people to pay me to do it.
So are you looking to change minds or gradually just work some things in there?
Well, that depends. I've started a 501(c) in Orange County called the HERD Foundation, which is an acronym for Holistic Education for Reversing Desertification.
Beautiful, yes.
And that's an educational 501(c) that we run here. It's in conjunction with our ranch tours. Now that I've got two other paid grazing contracts, I guess you'd like for a better word, we're branching out. We're trying to put another 1,000-acre ranch down here together with some neighbors. The group we're starting to branch off onto is called the Orange County Grazing Coalition. There's lots of money right now for fire prevention in California. That's mainly what we do with the other grazing contracts that I have. The emphasis is on me getting the fire loads down. And my impetus is on trying to save the environment. And
yeah, it's interesting the dovetailing that goes on and how with fire mitigation, you're going to help inform people about a whole lot of other things that are pointing toward regenerative agriculture, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, the thing of it is it, if you look at this thing really carefully, it's all graft and corruption. Okay, everybody in the fire department on both sides, federal and state, want grazing until you get past the battalion chief that has to fight fire. And as soon as the fire department becomes political, they don't want you around because you're solving a problem that they're trying to mitigate with a fire truck and a hand crew.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion, isn't it?
Everything I tell you is going to be another discussion.
That's my problem with interviewing people like yourself. I feel like, oh my gosh, there's so much knowledge packed in this being here.
There's 230,000 ungrazed acres in Orange County, okay, that need a cow on it. I'm paying for grass in Northern California that I could be getting paid for here if I could convince the people that are in control of it, which are environmental groups, conservation groups within cities and towns and state. All of these things are run, mitigated, and managed by PhD environmentalists.
Right.
PhD environmentalists, all of them went to school 40, 50, 60 years ago. All of them's premise on the purpose of the environment and how it run is wrong. Completely, absolutely, totally.
Yes, understood.
Need to be tried, convicted, a few of them hung for environmental degradations that they've caused over the past.
Now you're sounding like a cowboy from 200 years ago. Hanging anybody.
Well, you know what I mean.
I know.
They have caused problems that have killed people. And
yes.
They won't change. And the reason they won't change is because they're in the position of power. And
right.
The minute you do a holistic plant grazing problem, you don't need a PhD anymore to run the environment.
Right. You need to be speaking with folks that are literally out in the field like yourself. What is your biggest concern or effort in keeping a healthy herd? Is having a closed herd solely for health reasons?
No, it's for commingling genes that have the ability to pass on fertility and growth traits at a higher rate.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you don't inbreed, you got to crossbreed. Crossbreed is a joke because if you're in business for 40 or 50 years, you got a herd that looks like something out of a zoo.
So what is your biggest concern or effort in keeping a healthy herd in that case?
I have no idea. I've been on this ranch 25 years, and I bring my long yearling bulls down here, and we get them fat here, and we sell them out of here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have never lost a bull that I brought in healthy on that ranch. In 25 years.
That's amazing.
We lose a cow or two every year on the other ranch. You can't kill these things. They don't get sick. I've been vaccinated in 35 years. I don't dehorn them. I don't wean them. We don't do anything. I turn the damn things out, go out there 1 week a year, gather everybody I know that can really rope and ride, put the damn things in the corral, sort out the dries, sort out the beef, and brand the calves. That is the only management practice I do.
Yes.
These are as close to a wild herd of buffalo as anything you've ever seen.
Yeah, well, I've seen pictures and little videos, and it's certainly not only a beautiful ranch, but the cattle are just amazing looking, for sure, so healthy. And is there a moment looking back, Frank, that pointed you in the direction of being such a caring and conscious cowboy? I mean, you've been doing this practice for so long.
I decided on my 8th birthday I wanted to be a cowboy. I had a mentor that was fiscally and environmentally responsible.
Lovely.
We didn't own any ranch, but we took care of the ones we had. And his major premise with me was, you want to leave every piece of ground you go on better than you found it.
Yeah, pretty simple. Pretty simple
so
statement,
Your joy in life is to make improvements wherever you can. And that led me to Jan Bosma, which taught me about environmental efficiency with cattle, functional efficiency. I met Alan Savory in 1982 at the first meeting he had here in Bilton, California.
Well, that was Insight, yes.
Pete Jamison and I went to that meeting, and he and I have done a little to a lot of this ever since.
Well, from the get-go, you've held that humane treatment of your animals is the highest priority, and a wise person will see it includes everything from the soil to processing the animals to human health and the actual health of the planet. Would you share a key point or two that you do in your operation that plays into this gold standard that you hold?
Well, the standard is the cycle itself. In other words, if you heal the ground, you can raise cattle on it that are healthy, and that when you eat them, you can come to my place and buy real food and eat it. It's expensive, but I got it. By the same time, when I take that money and I put it back in the ground and recycle things. So this is a big-ass cycle, but all the points play a totally equal but functional role in the system, and the secret is just to keep the cycle going.
Right. Now, I imagine, because of what you've been saying earlier, that the politics are probably one of the hardest parts of this. But if we're talking the actual ground, how do you look at your land? Share with us something that you see that makes you move in a certain direction to keep it healthy.
Well, if you do the monitor, control, plan, replan scenario that Savory points out, what you're doing is you're always looking behind yourself.
And what does that mean?
What you're wanting to do is you're wanting to eat grass that has had a chance to put the deepest possible amount of roots down and then move on and then not come back to it until it has a second or third leaf growing on it, which is an indicator to you as the manager that you're actually got sufficient root system before you regraze it. This is simply how God ran buffalo before white man killed the predators.
Yeah. So this year, having had so much rain, you mentioned there's a lot of grass, but there's also a lot of weeds.
Yeah. I got the gnarliest weeds I've had in 25 years on this place.
So what are you going to do? Buy goats or?
No. I get about 1 million pounds of organic bell peppers every year. And that's how I move the cows around in the summertime.
Okay.
And that'll start probably next week. We'll shovel bell peppers out on the ground. The cows will eat them, knock it down, get the ground back to where it's just got litter on it, and we'll move.
All right. Frank, would you take just a moment to explain the physiology behind how and why grain-fed cattle gave eating red meat a bad rap in the first place?
Kind of a long story. Okay. Linolenic and linoleic acid are the three and six omega fatty acids that make up the structures of fat cells in the animals that we eat. If you feed a cow grain, the grain is got the endosperm in it, and the six omega fatty acids in that grain kernel are what the seed itself thrives on or lives on. It's not actually thriving until it sprouts, but what it lives on until conditions are right to sprout. Now, that's a long-term process because we've actually taken seeds from cracks in the boards of ships that are 350 years buried in the ocean and planted them and had them grow. So that's a long-term effect. So you've got a 6 omega fatty acid that nourishes the endosperm in every one of these grain cells. On the other side of the coin is that the grass plant itself, the stem and the leaf, are all 3 omega fatty acids. And all of them in the plant side, in the vegetative side, sixes and threes, are all a 16 carbon chain molecule. Now, if you take that animal and feed it grain, the cow will physiologically take the 6 omega fatty acid and take it up to AA and put it in the fat. And if you're feeding them a lot of grain, like a feedlot ration would feed a cow,
right,
you can get a 20-to-1 ratio of 6s to 3s from that scenario. By the same token, if you just let the cow eat grass, you get an abundance of 3s. Now, the most I've ever gotten by test is about 2.1 to 2, which is not quite what they tell me salmon does. But we've come pretty close. I've only tested the fat, I think, 3 times. It's expensive. Anyway, a cow takes this 16 carbon chain molecule, 3 omega fatty acid, turns it to an 18, which turns it into a 20 with 2 chemical reactions and 3 catalysts. And you eat it, and your body turns it into myelin, which becomes brain food. Now, there's no 6, and there's no other 3 on the planet that makes up the fatty acids in your brain. Your brain's 65% 3 omega fatty acids by weight. And all of those 3 omega fatty acids are 22 carbon chains, 3 omega fatty acids with 6 double bonds. And the only way you can get those is from eating an animal that ate grass or phytoplankton. So fish has it, the fatty fish, and ruminants.
Thank you for explaining that. That's an important piece that not a lot of people know about.
Well, everybody thinks that 3 omega fatty acids, 3 omega fatty acids. The problem is there's lots of them. And the ones that we need never get sophisticated enough to do us any good. Myelin, the 3 omega fatty acid in your brain, the only function it has is an insulator. It lines all your neurons, and it's a sophisticated enough molecule that your brain can actually fire 100,000 neurons a second and not short circuit.
Yes.
A cow can't do it, a dolphin can't do it, an elephant can't do it, and it all has to do with our ability to make myelin out of a 3 omega fatty acid. It is a total absolute weak link in the American diet.
Well, this leads right into my next question, which is wondering if it's true that grass-fed beef takes an additional 2 years to reach ideal fat content. And I know you're doing this. This is part of your practice. Do you find this to be a common practice among other grass-fed
No.
ranchers?
No. Okay, I'm going to tell you a secret. I do it for taste. I got a friend of mine that tries to do this with Angus. He's trying to get 1,100-pounder 24 months, and I get a 1,250-pounder at 30 or 36 months, depending on the rainfall. And he can't get his animals to taste good enough to get people to buy them.
Wow.
He just does not like his meat. Now, my thinking on this, without having any physiological way of proving it, is that flavonoids in muscles increase as you increase age. So there's some point, and I think, in my opinion, it's 30 months. At 30 months plus, animals get enough physical movement structure in their muscles that the muscle starts tasting good. The fat tastes good in this stuff, but there's not a lot of it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about an animal that's 17 to 20% fat walking off the range versus an animal that's walking out of a feedlot that's USDA prime that's 60% fat.
It's a good thing to go after taste. You're a rancher. You want to eat a good steak for all your effort, don't you?
Okay, now I've got 29 five-star ratings on my website and 1 one-star rating.
Uh-oh.
And the 1 one-star rating I left on because the gal wrote a page and a half, and the bottom line was it was the best meat she ever ate, but she thought I was an asshole. Which is true. She was a pest.
Well, apparently you were, too.
There you go.
Oh, well, I like that. Honesty.
About a hand-holder.
Yeah, there's an honesty. So I like it. You sell your beef in a tri-state area from California. What is the most popular cut that you sell?
Amazingly, Oregon meat sausage. I could sell 150 pounds, well, probably more like 300 now, but before COVID, I was selling about 150 pounds of Oregon meat sausage per month at $16 a pound. That's the same price as top sirloin?
Yes.
To make the same amount of Oregon meat sausage as steaks, I'd have had to have been selling twice as many animals.
Wow.
This was an artifact of the Weston Price Foundation. Marcia Ute invited me to a meeting 2001, and she said, we will buy every single piece of organ that you can bring to the meeting. So I brought 160 pounds of heart, liver, tongue, kidney, spleen, pancreas, thalamuses, tongues, and testicles, okay?
Okay.
Went to this meeting, there's 80 people there. I spoke for 20 minutes. They bought them all. I left there with hamburger left. I had steaks left, but they bought all the organs. So next month came by, and Marcia called me on the phone and said, we don't need you to speak, but come bring some meat. Only sold two packages of organs. The fact of the matter is everybody wants and needs organ meats. They just taste bad. So I got together with the butcher, and we started making sausage. And my organ meat sausage is not quite 80% organs, but it's a medley of all heart, liver, tongue, kidney, spleen, pancreas, thalamus, tongues, and testicles. But there's only 2 pounds of liver, and then I add 6 pounds of rump roast to a 25-pound batch. And we season it with the proprietary Italian seasoning that I own the label to.
All right.
And it is really good. People love it because it gives you a maximum dose of all the organ meats, and it's tasty enough that you can get it down.
Good.
People will buy a little bit of meat off of you if it's tough or doesn't taste good because it's good for you, but they won't buy a lot.
Right. No, certainly not. And what is your favorite steak?
I like the flat iron. I like them so much I get 45 a pound for them. If you want to own a 5-bar beef flat iron, you got to out to beat me for the meat.
All right. Well, how much of a stash do you need in a year?
Oh, God. Lady, I could eat 300 pounds of flat iron a year.
How much do you think you eat in a year?
Well, probably not 50 pounds, maybe 60. But everybody seems to have my opinion because I get the same for flat irons as I do fillets, and they sell just as quickly.
Well, Frank, I've heard you say animals make their own living and your job is to grow the grass. It's certainly a job.
Well, actually, my job is to grow the microbiota that grows the grass.
Right, yeah. It's certainly a bigger job than the words imply, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's really helpful when you know what you're doing. It's really helpful if you know what you're supposed to be doing. Unfortunately, in biology, you don't get it always done. Managing complexity is the hardest thing there is to do, and everybody wants a silver bullet that they just take and things happen, and nothing in life happens that way. If you can't sit back and look at every situation and try to derive a insightful and or meaningful conclusion from what happened, you're wasting your time. You got to keep on it. It's like I've been here 25 years on this ranch. I've been chasing cows in Orange County for 65 years here. I'll be 75 in July.
All right. Well, happy birthday. It's coming up.
Yep.
I know you're going to celebrate with some flat iron steak too, right?
I don't have any flat iron steak.
What?
I haven't had a flat iron in 6 or 8 months.
Oh, no. Well, I'm glad you still had the energy for the interview.
I eat a lot of grass-fed beef. I butchered 27 heads last year, May, June. Yeah, probably just right around now. And I ran out of that meat 5 months ago.
Oh, my gosh.
You get the good and the bad. And I've never seen a 7-foot high artichoke. I got them this year.
Good rain, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I also got 18 grain rain. The green feed lasted almost 30 days longer, visibly, on the ground. The 3 ranches I had, you could go from green grass to brown grass on all 4 sides for almost a month. So when you boil this thing back to fire protection, I've actually shortened the fire season by 30 days just by doing this. The other side of the corn, before October, we'll get the fire hazard down to where it won't burn anyway.
Nice. Well, cool. Well, Frank, is there anything else you'd like to share, considering what we've spoken about already today? Or
the problem is our government is systematically eliminating our food processing system.
Well, I wondered, because I've heard when you have grass-fed beef, oftentimes it just goes in the mix with all the other beef. Do you have any problems with processing your grass-fed beef?
No. Real grass-fed beef looks like grass-fed beef. They can't switch carcass on you, and they don't want to.
Mm-hmm. There's no faking it.
No, this is absolutely red meat. It's absolutely yellow fat. I can walk into a kill plant that's got 500 or 600 carcasses hanging, and I can walk right to mine. If you ate raw grass-fed beef, you would need to eat nothing else besides water and salt.
What percentage do you think, when you go to markets, do you think it's all grass-fed beef?
No. I can't tell you about Denver, Colorado, but I'll tell you about Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
80% of the grass-fed beef that's sold in Orange and L.A. County comes out of a feedlot in Bakersfield where they feed the cattle carrots.
Shit.
It turns to fat orange.
Oh.
That gives them the impression.
Wow.
Carotene is not vitamin A, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
wow.
If you feed a cow carrots, the fat turns orange. That's all they feed them. They get carrots, salt, and water. And it looks like grass-fed beef. They bring it in here, kill it, put their own label on it, and sell it. And I've caught one of the big funches down here had about 480 pounds of grass-fed filet mignon. It was the farmer's market. And that takes 48 head of cattle to make that amount of grass-fed filet.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And we caught them. I had some meat that they shipped me that didn't have labels on it. You can't sell it without a label, so I had to take it back, get them to make labels and put the labels on. They did it while I waited. And there's 480 pounds of grass-fed filet in these boxes. And Juan, the guy that runs the plant, I've known for 15 years, and I knew who the rancher was. I said, hey, where'd you get 480 pounds of filet? And he said, I bought them off Harris. And it had his label. It had grass-fed, locally grown, yada, yada, yada. And it was right out of the feedlot. You want to buy food in America, find a man that raises it.
Right.
Ask him what his standards are. If he meets your standards, buy it and eat it.
Dylan, your knowledge and passion for permaculture design led you to broad-scale landscape regeneration and holistic planned grazing. Tell us about the land that you ranch on and the reason you settled on raising sheep and lambs.
Yeah, sure. So I raise sheep on a number of different land bases, and that's primarily two different partnerships I have. I have a lease on about 1,000 acres in Ojai, California, and it's a dry Mediterranean oak savanna landscape characterized by annual grasses and coast live oak forest. And the other land bases I raise things on are through a partnership with another business that I also work in as a shepherd, called Shepherdess Land and Livestock, run by Brittany Cole Bush, a contract grazing business where we are hired to go graze other people's land for fire mitigation, soil health, weed abatement, invasive species reduction, things like that. And so my sheep also graze on a number of different land bases around Ventura and Los Angeles County.
That is such a great service that you offer to people and the land and for the earth, obviously. And are sheep and lambs the best kind of animal to do that as far as being used to being on different types of properties and then having a really varied diet? How does that work? And I know you've worked with cattle in the past, so can you compare and contrast those a little bit?
Yeah, each one of these different grazing animals has a role to play in a system, and it's about choosing the tool that holistically fits best for what you're trying to accomplish. And when I say holistically fits best, I don't just mean based upon the landscape, but also upon the time you have, the equipment you have, the expertise you have, the network you have. These are all things you want to take into consideration when you're choosing how to apply a particular grazing animal to a particular set of goals. That being said, sheep do fit very well on many of the landscapes that we are asked to graze. A lot of them are extremely hilly and mountainous. They're great climbers, not as great as the goats, which are also run in Shepherdess Land and Livestock, but they do better than most. A common generalization that is made about the difference between goats and sheep is that sheep will graze more and browse less, and that goats will browse more and graze less, which is in general true. But especially our sheep, they are in truth brush sheep in the sense that they browse a great deal, and there's almost nothing that they won't eat that the goats do. And so I will say that the goats do browse a little bit more, but the sheep are right there, right behind them. And so they do a really good job, not only in the coast live oak forest that we're often grazing in, but also in the chaparral and sagebrush. They can cause the necessary amount of impact that we're often looking for in order to regenerate what are mostly overrested or overgrazed areas.
And what gives you the sign that, okay, folks, time to move out here?
There's a couple things I'm looking for. First off, I think most importantly, I'm making sure that I'm not creating significant amounts of bare ground, and ideally any bare ground. Bare ground is going to be the most detrimental thing that you can leave behind when you're grazing, and it's because of how fragile everything else beneath it, the microorganisms, the soil structure, everything that allows life to happen in our soil is then threatened by the bare soil, and that it's threatened also just by the impact of rainfall falling. It needs the protection of at least a litter, if not a growing plant. And also the sun. I took some temperatures with a laser temperature gun last year when we were working in the heat of summer, and the bare ground in some of the canyons we were working in was over 165 degrees. And that kills just about everything operating, in the top inch of the soil where most of our life is. Yeah.
That is very hot. I had no idea, but it doesn't really surprise me, especially where you are. And I love that you're a first-generation shepherd and rancher. And are you the first to bring lamb and sheep onto property that you are on yourself? What natural patterns in the landscape need your attention for both the land and the animals to thrive? Now, you just mentioned the heat. How do you go about regenerating a property?
Yeah, the recent history of the 1,000-acre land base that I'm ranching in Ojai, for the last 50 years, its only real use as far as livestock went was to oversummer horses from a local private school. And so there is in the range of anywhere from 50 to 70 horses there for at least 3 months a year. And they were given free run of the ranch, so no planned grazing. And what happens there is that those animals will return to their favorite plants and overgraze them before they have time to replenish their nutrient stores and root systems. And what that will do is result in a landscape of primarily annual grasses, particularly in the pasture areas, because that is the only type of plant that is not dependent on having a root system that is going to be thriving year after year, because their whole life plan is to grow and die every year. And so that's primarily what you do see in the pastures there. In order to go in and start regenerating those landscapes, what I'll do is build paddocks at high density so that I have a tightly packed mob of sheep grazing close together. Doing this greatly increases their trampling effect. It lowers their selection in terms of what they're grazing, so they're not only grazing their favorite plants, but also grazing everything else in there as they're competing with one another for food. It makes the dung dispersal across the paddock much more even, rather than one place getting dung and urine and another place not. At certain densities, you have dung in every square foot of the paddock, which is really what you're looking for. And in their increased mob mentality and the increased trample effect, we are able to start breaking down the capping on the surface that is a result of often bare ground and impact from animals during rainy parts of the season and things like that. And so as I build them into these tight paddocks, I then move them into another one and prevent them from ever coming back to that particular paddock until it's had a significant amount of rest. And what a significant amount of rest looks like is enough time for those plants, particularly perennial plant species, to regrow their nutrient and root systems so that once they are impacted again, it doesn't bankrupt them and they can continue to grow deeper and deeper root systems year after year. On this particular ranch, RMR Ranch, the best sign of this, because it's been so overgrazed for nearly a century or half century, is that we have something called Italian ryegrass growing there, which is an intermediate plant. And what that means is that Italian rye when it's growing in degraded soils, behave as an annual. But as you begin to manage the grazing on a landscape better, those same plants get the opportunity to start developing a bunching type growing system and deepening their root systems and establishing a perennial nature, which will allow their roots to go deeper into the soil, grow longer into the season, and ultimately extend the shoulder seasons, the grazing seasons, and keep the soil alive. And so this is the beginning of that regeneration process that we're working towards on any overgrazed or overrested ranch.
That is just brilliant, isn't it? The way the grasses will become a perennial if they're given the opportunity.
Yeah, and it's not the case for every single one. And so I'm always looking, as I begin to keep the soil alive longer, to identify the presence of more of these intermediate and true perennial grasses coming back. Warm season perennial grasses are extremely rare in California. There's a whole discussion surrounding that. But right now, there is a good handful of cool season perennial grasses that are just looking to get their feet under them and get the oxidized, overrested parts of the ranch off of them and be able to kick into high gear. And so we're still in the beginning stages of regeneration here at this particular ranch. And so it's going to be really interesting moving forward.
Yes, it certainly sounds like it. And excuse my ignorance, but does the scrubby, bushy landscape provide what grasses do as far as the nourishment goes for the animals? What are the different nutrients in the different types of plants for those animals?
Without having great knowledge of the specific different nutrients that you find, say, between a cool season grassland and sagebrush or chaparral, I do know that the sagebrush and chaparral does offer a significantly different nutrient profile, and also, I think even more noticeably, secondary compounds that are also present in those plants. An annual grass at almost every stage is readily grazed by the sheep that we bring onto these pastures, whereas I notice a lot more of seasonal preference with a lot of the sagebrush and chaparral, where there's plants that they will devour very happily and readily at certain times of the year and will not touch at other times of the year. And I know that in general, people who are doing studies on these things are also noticing the self-medication, the self-treatment
right,
by consuming these secondary compounds. And so I don't have deep particular knowledge of how they're utilizing some of these things, but it is interesting to see their preference at different times of the year.
Yes, well, certainly you're noticing it, and they're thriving by having that opportunity. And now that Regen Ag is becoming a catchphrase and the meaning of grass-fed really needs to be scrutinized, what is behind your description of beyond grass-fed for your flocks?
Yeah, so part of the reason I say that is because when you get down to the legal definition of grass-fed, you know, there is many different ways to get around that. I actually don't even know the specific definitions for each, like grass-fed and grass-finished. I do know that you can have a grass-fed animal that, you know, isn't pasture-raised. You could be, say, bringing cut bales of alfalfa, and I think that would be technically grass-fed. And then also, say you do have a pasture-raised animal being raised on arable pasture, they might be being raised on pasture of just alfalfa or just alfalfa and oats or something like that. And so they're pasture-raised or they're grass-raised, but they're ultimately eating a small selection of different plants, which exposes them to a narrow selection of nutrients and secondary compounds and that whole realm of things. The reason that I'm using and comfortable using a term like beyond grass-fed is because they are truly accessing what the entire Southern California, dry Mediterranean, coast live oak, annual, mountain annual grassland has to offer. You know, I've been throwing out the number over 150 plants within a year, and I think I'm being conservative when I say that.
I bet,
but
yes.
They're truly exposed and eating in a very diverse palette every year, and science is only beginning to understand the way that that is changing the final product at the end, not only the health of the animal, but also the final product at the end. We do have medical issues come up, but it's seemingly so rare compared to other forms of raising livestock because they're moving quickly and because they have such a balanced nutrition and very likely because of their exposure to these secondary compounds and their access to be able to self-medicate.
Yes, and I think that self-medication is so important, and the animals really do have that awareness, don't they, about going to a certain plant for what they need in that moment.
Yeah, it for sure is letting me tap into the intuition of the livestock that I'm raising. And that's also enhanced by the fact that the breed I use is so well suited to the ecosystem I'm raising it in, which is a Katahdin Dorper cross. And they both came originally from breeds being raised in Africa and crossed with some UK breeds and crossed with some Caribbean breeds and adapted as they were brought into the United States, and they are just very well suited to this brushy, dry Mediterranean landscape. And I tend to see that I'm dealing with much less medical issues, and to the point where my husbandry is probably reduced as far as a skill because of how little work I really need to do to keep them healthy.
Yes, one of the interviews I did for Cultivated Audio, the rancher was going, it's like a Sunday afternoon around here every day.
Yeah, I wouldn't go just about as that.
Right.
It's nice, and it's getting better. You know, there's a lot of other people in California raising this same breed, whether they're ranching for meat or whether they're doing contract grazing. And there's a lot of great work being done in breeding programs and collecting data. If they're not something that we've lambed out in Ojai Valley ourselves, I buy from Piscina's Ranch, which is about 5 hours north of us. And they're doing great regenerative work up there as well, and have put a lot of work into their breeding program. And it shows even 5 hours down south.
Very nice. And we'll talk more about the product that you have, but tell us about providing the grazing services. And is the main reason you're asked fire mitigation?
Yeah, so the grazing services offered by Shepherdess Land Livestock is primarily hired for fire mitigation. I'd say there is a lot of different reasons. You know, there is also weed abatement, and there is also the soil health purposes. But Ojai has what was at the time in, I believe, the end of 2017, the Thomas Fire, which was at the time the largest fire to have occurred in California. At this point now, it's the eighth largest fire because of how greatly the intensity of fires have increased. But this is something that has brought the need of our local community, the need for grazing, to the forefront of people's minds and really brought a lot of education and awareness to the issue. And so there's a lot of movement around our community and a lot of active community members and working on getting more grazing to the areas. And there's an organization called the Ojai Community Supported Grazing Program. And they work on specifically allocating funds from the community and from the state government to enhance grazing prescription specifically to reduce the intensity of fires around the county.
I bet it's so satisfying for you to see, especially because you know what surprises are about to appear, right? Once you start doing all of that for mitigation, there's a whole lot of other things that are going to happen, which is more perennial grass and much healthier landscape.
Yeah, when we go in and graze a place, you know, there's a lot of different metrics that as we work with different fire departments, I'm getting more educated on what it is they really are looking for. And when they're trying to create a landscape that is less fire prone, not only less fire prone, but for when there is a fire there, it is more manageable by ground crews within the fire department. And so, you know, some numbers I've heard thrown out there is grazing until there's less than 1,000 pounds of dry matter on the ground. One thing that is really optimistic, because, you know, this is a labor-intensive process to bring our sheep out there,
sure,
and
pack
them tight, is that, you know, when we go into these over-rested landscapes that have become so fire-prone, there might be 4,000 pounds of dry matter there. That dry matter isn't the result of a single year of growth in each one of these areas. And so we can go in there and remove a huge backlog of dry matter and of growth, so that even if we are going to return there every year, the likeliness that a fire goes through there and catches the canopies of our coast live oaks on fire, which are evolved to withstand events like this, is greatly lessened. And so as we do more of this work, I think we'll see some of the accumulating effects of having been there every year and having managed the ecology there every year so that it's not going to be as intensive as a process once we start getting our feet under us. And there's all these secondary effects to the grazing that reduce the intensity of fires, aside from just removing the fire fuels themselves. Things like just having in general more moist environment, an environment that holds water better as the soil structure becomes more porous and can hold more water, the plants wetter for longer throughout the year. There's a whole slew of secondary effects that come in there that makes it a less fire-prone environment the more that we do this work well.
Absolutely, yes. And thank you so much for being involved in this, because it just adds to the brilliant system that Regen Ag is. And wow, what a service you're providing. So thank you.
It's a great pleasure to be a shepherd in Ohio.
Yeah, I bet. Well, there's a large-scale waste, as we all know, in modern-day processing. And in the past, there was a less wasteful communal culinary culture. What are you doing to help restore these practices? I know you see the importance in that.
Yeah, so the way that I've designed Bokehouse Earth and Husbandry is to focus primarily on whole animal sales. We'll sell half animal and whole animal to individuals. I work primarily with chefs who are up to the challenge of taking on the whole animal. Often these chefs will break it down in-house. But what I'm doing is putting the burden of the bounty, which is a term I've taken from Brandon Sheard of Farmstead Meatsmith. When you slaughter an animal, you don't end up with 50 pounds of steaks. You know, there's about 2 pounds, 3 pounds of steaks in your lamb, and then a great deal of other parts of the animal, including things like not only the leg and shoulder, but also the head and the liver and the kidneys. In the same way that a lot of meat eaters feel responsible in the sense that they would like to have been there or at least experience the killing of the animal because they're reaping the benefits of its life, there's another set of responsibilities that come along with that, which is not just knowing what it takes to take the life of the animal in order to reap the benefits of it, but it's also to learn how to use what is the whole animal. The animal is not just built of steaks, and so there's this onus on people to learn to rekindle that culinary culture that fills every single person's ancestry, traditional culture, and learn how to cook with kidneys and learn how to cook with liver and intestines and all these sorts of things, which ultimately reinvigorate the whole culinary culture of whatever community you participate in. I've shifted that responsibility as much as I can and encourage people to take on that challenge and adventure, which is most of my customers, is why they're reaching out to me.
I know you're involved with the Weston Price Foundation, and from Sally Fallon years ago, I was learning about all of that.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting that some of the least used parts, and by least used, I don't even mean only a few people in our culture are buying them, but, you know, so undervalued that the majority, you know, well above 95% of the highest value, highest nutrition parts of the animal, especially at our USDA plants, are taken from the animal and thrown right into the trash. And it's very strange for a country that has become almost an entire food desert to be doing when, you know, there's a lot of people lacking nutrition, that we throw the most valuable, the most nutritious aspects of our animals into the trash. People are getting sick from not having enough nutrients. And so there is growing movements and more culture directed at redeveloping these sorts of things. And they do make up a good demographic of the people that I'm selling to.
Speaking of the people you sell to, you mentioned the chefs that are buying half or whole animals. And what about the customers? We know the benefits to that, which you've just been speaking about. How hard of a sale is it? And do you offer classes, or I'm sure you're just one-on-one, either on the street or at a market or on the phone even, helping share this information from people? Are you finding more and more people are willing to encompass and take advantage of this type of information and benefit from it?
Yes. My business is still very young in the sense that I've been operating it just for a couple of years. And I'm saying that just because there's enough pull out there that I'm still looking to meet the demand of the amount of people interested in having access to this sort of thing. And they're very willing to learn. And I get a lot of questions, whether it's from private chefs or whether it's from individual customers who have filled a freezer with an animal, about how to use the belly, about how I like to debone a shoulder, and things like that. I want to put together more and more videos and materials to help with that educational process. And I am going to be offering more classes. What I've done so far is I've had clients that purchase a whole lamb and then they'll come to my butcher shop and we'll break it down together.
Oh, nice.
And during that time, they're able to ask a lot more questions and we're able to kind of build a game plan to at least get off the floor with, you know, some of these less used cuts. It's the biggest barrier to entry. Education is a huge part of it. And I love that part because it's another aspect of my passion. It's just another community building aspect of the way this business is designed that I get to have these ongoing conversations from people and learn recipes from other people who came from cultures where a little bit more of this whole animal eatery is still intact. As much as I might like to spend a day at a farmer's market selling 1 pound cuts, I've really forced my business to focus on the whole animal. I want you to have to invite other people over and enjoy the communion that is brought about by making a meal and sharing that. This is coming from someone, you know, when I'm out with the sheep, I do have a lot of meals by myself by nature of the job, but it just accentuates the value of being able to share your meal and experience communion with people you love.
Yeah. What is your favorite cut of meat?
It's a difficult one, but I will say I really like braising. So just throwing a shoulder in a pot with some vegetables and potatoes and things like that is always a great option. But I think what I'm going to have to say right now, because I've just finally nailed it, is cooking the lamb belly well. And I like to braise that and sear it with some potatoes and wine that's been sitting out for a little while. And it's an effortlessly good cut of meat and something that I'd never seen before I started raising sheep myself.
Dylan, what is the favorite part of your day?
I think the simplest and most obvious and most reoccurring favorite part of the day is you've worked all day and, you know, maybe tucking sheep back in that might have escaped or messing with a solar system. And at the end of the day, it's all done and the sun is setting and you just get to look at your sheep on the side of a mountain as the sun's setting. It's just so beautiful. It's really a gift that shepherds get at the end of the day. It's a sense of peace and always very grateful to have the work that I do at that point in the day.
Probably some of the best California dreaming, lives well spent, Frank Fitzpatrick and Dylan Boken. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.